From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show today, we'll revisit two very different musical milestones. First, the Leonard Bernstein musical On the Town has a storied history from its debut on Broadway in 1944 to a film version that gutted most of Bernstein's music to stage revivals that closed quickly. Well, we'll hear about a new version that hews closely to Bernstein's original vision. Plus, a cutting-edge orchestra is revisiting a progressive rock classic from the 70s. That's a little bit from the 1973 album Tubular Bells by Mike Oldfield. We'll hear some of it in a new arrangement in our studio when the Wordless Music Orchestra performs later. But first, a different 70s icon returns with that voice.
Oh, can't you see? Love is the drug.
If you're a fan of Brian Ferry, like I am, chances are you first heard his unmistakable voice on the records he made with this adventurous and experimental group, Roxy Music. You're hearing their hit Love is the Drug in the background. Or you might have first encountered Brian Ferry's voice in his solo career, often reworking songs by other people and scoring hits of his own. His new album is called Avonmore, and it finds Brian Ferry collaborating with an all-star cast, including Ronnie Spector, guitarist Nile Rodgers, the bassist Flea, and on this song, Johnny Marr of the Smiths. Soldier of Fortune, a song co-written with Johnny Marr. It's from Brian Ferry's new album, Avonmore, and it brings Brian to our Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Good to see you.
When I see a title and don't know what to make of it, I go to the Google and see if I can figure...
Did you find any success?
All I found was like a dairy and a town in Pennsylvania and a hotel in London.
Oh, really? No, well,
tell me this is not an album about a hotel in London.
No, but it's about London. It's the location of where my studio is, in fact. So it's a part of London. And that's where we made the record.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a little bit of a less ambitious title, perhaps, than Avalon, the distant, you know.
It doesn't have those Irish mists surrounding it so much, but you can invent anything you like to go with Avonmore.
So this is the first single that this is the track that people have heard so far from the record.
Yeah, that's right. It's the one that's out, being played at the moment, yes.
Right.
People seem to like it. I'm very pleased.
So what's happening in this song in Loop de Lee?
It's got a lot of different players on it, that's for sure. And I think you mentioned Johnny Marr earlier. He's a key person in the kind of lineup of, on the record.
And Marcus Miller, the great jazz player.
Marcus is a brilliant player. He used to play with Miles Davis when he was a young lad. And so his credentials are very high.
And they are unimpeccable.
Yeah, they are.
Or they... No, they are.
They're
impeccable.
Unimpeachable.
Unimpeachable and impeccable. I need to stop talking. Yeah. Let's hear some music. This is from Brian Ferry's new album called Avonmore.
You wake up. Where are you? What's on your mind? Confusion. Can't face it. Yeah.
music from Brian Ferry called Loop De Lie. That is the opening track from the new album called Avonmore, which comes out on November 17th. There's a big rotating cast of characters on this record. And that, that you know, for all the solo records that you've done, you know, for all the spectrum of music that you've covered over the years, that seems to be consistent, that you... You know, you have this incredible pool of musical friends to draw on.
Yeah, I mean, you build up relationships with people which last for years, you know. And at the same time, you're always looking out for young players as well who will kind of join the club. And my son Tara, he's early 20s. He's playing drums on the record. He's really good. And it's good to have young guys who bring a sort of bit of a youthful enthusiasm to the project. But a lot of the guys are also kind of, as you said, like old friends of mine.
Yeah.
Niall, Marcus, Chris Spedding's on there.
Had you worked with Flea of Red Hot Chili Peppers before this?
We did a couple of tracks. I met him out in L.A. I actually met him a few times in London. We have friends in common. He's a great friend of Damien Hirst, actually, the artist who lives in London, who I know also. And Flea's a character. I mean, he's a great player as well.
Yeah. Do you own any Damien Hirsts? Do you have any dot paintings?
Sadly, no. But Flea was playing this beautiful guitar, which was customized by Damien, with butterflies on it, which is pretty much a priceless guitar.
I would think so. Brian Ferry's new album is called Avonmore. It's got a whole bunch of new songs that you've written. Loop De Lie is a great track.
I'm really enjoying
that. Mm. But when you get to the end of the album, there are a couple of covers that are just absolute revelations.
Oh, great. Well, as you said earlier, I've kind of covered quite a lot of songs in my career so far, and it's a big part of my oeuvre, if you like.
Yeah.
And it adds a different dimension, I find, you know, to my own writing. And although this record, Avonmore, was supposed to be an album of all my new songs, which it is, there are eight new ones, and I thought it would make it a bit more kind of all-embracing if I added these two covers which I'd done. One is Send in the Clowns, which is the Stephen Sondheim song. You know, I've always liked Broadway, and some of the greatest pop songs are written for kind of Broadway hits, you know, like people like Cole Porter wrote for the stage.
Yeah.
And
call the Great American Songbook.
That's it, yes. Yeah. And I've taken on a few of those songs in the past.
And I just want to point out
this is a beautiful lyric.
You did that way before Rod Stewart or Willie Nelson, you know, way before that became a thing.
In 73, we did, I think, the...
With These Foolish Things.
These Foolish Things, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Gardenia perfume lingering on a pillow, while strawberries only 7 francs a kilo. And still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you.
I remember scratching my head over that one.
Yeah, well, we like to think it was ahead of its time, you know.
Yeah, well, it absolutely turned out to be.
It was certainly fun to do at the time. And it was a great holiday away from my own songwriting, kind of, to do something like that, which is a different sort of a breath of fresh air, really. Because the songs I was writing were a bit darker than those. Mm. They were kind of quite light, some of them.
Well, now, Send in the Clowns, you know...
That's
for
a
all
dark
that,
song.
That's a very dark, bitter little
is.
Tune.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, this is unlike any rendition of Send in the Clowns that I've ever heard. What's your own experience? Did you grow up with this song?
I remember hearing it by Sinatra, of course. He did a great version of it. And there was a Barbara Streisand version, which was very good. It's been covered by a lot of people over the years. It's a great song.
Let's hear that. As you say, it's been covered a lot, but never like this. Let's hear Brian Ferry's version of Send in the Clowns from the new album. You're saying Avonmore.
Avonmore.
His eyes bled. Don't you approve? Water keeps tearing around. One who can't move.
Brian Ferry's version of Send In the Clowns from his new album, Avonmore, which comes out on November 17th. Brian Ferry is with us on Soundcheck today. Parts of that almost remind me of, like, Revolver-era Beatles.
Well, that's a compliment. Yeah, that's
it is. I mean it as a compliment. When the arrangement gets that big and that symphonic and that cinematic, and you're just kind of floating those vocals out there, I mean, obviously you can do that in the studio. How are you going to do that live?
With some difficulty. But I'm sure we'll make a good job of it. The band I've got with me at the moment is incredibly versatile. It's a young band, and it's sometimes difficult to find a band that can be versatile enough to cover all the various bases that I've covered over the years, you know.
Well, and you have covered many of them. I mean, from the Great American Songbook to Roxy Music to your own stuff. And in some cases, you've brought those worlds have collided. And I'm thinking of the album The Jazz Age.
Oh, yes.
Where you did the kind of 1920s versions of your old Roxy Music stuff.
Yeah, that was a great project. We all enjoyed working on that.
So it was credited to the Brian Ferry Orchestra.
Yeah. That sounds very grand.
Yeah, well.
And they were great players, so orchestra sounds good.
It also puts the focus on the song rather than the singer.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. And on the tunes, on the melodies. And great hearing those acoustic instruments of the orchestra together with the electric guitars as well. So it was quite an interesting show.
Yeah, and great fun for Roxy Music fans, too, because it would often take, like, maybe half a minute or a minute before you realize, oh my God, that's Virginia Plain.
Or recognize the song.
For example, here, take a listen to the opening of Roxy Music's Do the Strand.
There's a new sensation, a fabulous creation, a danceable solution to teenage revolution. Do the Strand, love.
So that's Brian Ferry and Roxy Music, 1973, the original version of Do the Strand. Skip ahead to 2012. Here's the Brian Ferry Orchestra's version of that same music. Brian Ferry, you sound good as a clarinet.
Yeah, I'm not too bad.
Now, it's not only the arrangements, which are really tight, but also the way the album was recorded. It almost sounds like, you did everything but fly in, surface noise.
That's about we wanted it to sound period. And yeah, we did it in my studio in London, where we made Avonmore also. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a versatile little place.
Yeah.
And we had kind of a mic in the center of the room, in the traditional way that they used to record in the 20s. But we also had kind of individual miking as well to cover ourselves.
Right.
And it was done with a real kind of joy, and it's quite infectious, that.
Yeah. And the album called The Jazz Age from the Brian Ferry Orchestra. Mm. Brian Ferry's new album is Avonmore, out on November 17th. He's with me here in the Soundcheck studio. So the last that we heard of you before this new record was probably the Great Gatsby music that you did for the Baz Luhrmann film.
Yeah.
And there you were doing exactly that, taking this Amy Winehouse song along with Beyoncé and kind of recasting it for two very different singers.
Yeah, it was an interesting project because Baz Luhrmann, the director of the Great Gatsby, he heard the Jazz Age record and asked if we'd do some stuff for his movie. And I'm very pleased to be involved because I was a huge fan of Scott Fitzgerald's writing all my life.
Did you, was Great Gatsby one of those, did you read it as a teenager?
I read it as a teenager.
Yeah.
The American Dream, a guy who came from nothing and created, a whole world.
Did that resonate with you?
Oh, sure.
As the son of a miner?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. And, anything is possible.
Well, let's hear Brian Ferry with Beyoncé from the film soundtrack to The Great Gatsby. Amy Winehouse's Back to Black, sung by Beyoncé, and before that you heard the voice of my guest, Brian Ferry, from the soundtrack to the Baz Luhrmann film The Great Gatsby. Brian Ferry's new album is called Avonmore. It's out on November 17th. I was listening to the new Pink Floyd record.
Oh, really?
I mean, a little bit of it. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing about that is, you know, this new Pink Floyd record is based on old tapes that they had done in a session like 20 years ago. Mm. Got me to wondering, are there old Roxy Music tapes that...
There might be one or two lying around somewhere in the vaults, yes.
Because at this point, you know, you've worked with all those guys again. Eno, Manzanera, yeah. Andy McKay. I mean, so yes. I know the question comes up all the time, but... What's stopping a Roxy Music reunion?
You never know. I guess the main thing is that I've been so busy the last few years working on my solo tours and projects in the studio as well. But, there are one or two items which are unfinished, which would be nice to complete one day.
A little finished, unfinished business to take care of.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
More than that, you know there's not.
The other cover on the new record, Avonmore, is the song Johnny and Mary by Robert Palmer.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 70s, as the 70s turned into the 80s, you had the rock frontman, Robert Plant, Roger Daltrey, you know, with the open shirt and, you know. And then at the other end, you had people like you and Robert Palmer. Mm-hmm. Very sophisticated, very debonair, with a little air of... Louche lounge, you know.
Thank you. We needed that.
Did you see in Robert Palmer a kindred spirit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we grew up with the same kind of music, a lot of kind of early R&B and that kind of stuff. And I like to think he would really enjoy this version of Johnny and Mary that we did. It was one of his songs that I really liked for many years.
And the song, the original song, has kind of a light, almost new wave character to it. This version really taps into something very kind of lonely and intimate and sad.
Yeah, it is a sad song, and it's a very particular song. It's like a narrative, and it's kind of hypnotic in a way.
Yeah, it's from the new record by my guest Brian Ferry. The album's called Avonmore. The song is called Johnny and Mary. And Brian, it's been great fun having you with us. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Johnny's always running around trying to find certainty. He needs all the world to confirm that he ain't lonely. Mary counts the walls, knows he tires easily. Johnny thinks the world would be right if it could buy truth.
Coming up next, a new revival of Leonard Bernstein's On the Town has arrived on Broadway. Hear the story behind the musical, and we'll talk with an early cast member, as well as Bernstein historian Carol Oja, next. And by the way, we just announced our next show in the Green Space. It's a special Halloween party with the band Primus. Their latest album is a new look at the music from the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So, we want you to come in a costume inspired by that film. It's all happening October 30th, the day before Halloween, 1 p.m., a special afternoon show. For details and tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Leonard Bernstein is one of a handful of individuals who will forever be an indelible part of New York's history and culture. His work continues to be performed and studied and cherished as kind of classic New Yorkophilia. A new revival of On the Town, the show's third, opens on Broadway tomorrow, and joining me here in the studio to talk about this musical is Carol Oja, author most recently of Bernstein Meets Broadway, Collaborative Art in a Time of War. Carol, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And we're also joined by Billy Allen, an early cast member of On the Town. She is a longtime member of the New York theater community. Billy, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So what is your memory of the original? How soon into the process did you come on the scene?
Well, I came in near the end of the Broadway run and took the national tour, and I was fresh out of ballet school, fresh in New York. I'm from Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, and it was just magic.
Well, now, Billy uses the word fresh. Carol, what is it about On the Town that keeps this now, what, 70-year-old work fresh enough to be opening again?
Well, its initial production was fresh in the sense of having very young creative artists, Leonard Bernstein, Betty Comden, Adolph Green, Jerome Robbins, their very first Broadway show, lots of young talent in the show, including Billy. And over the years, the show has not been produced a lot. There have been a few revivals, but not a huge number. Perhaps it was eclipsed by a West Side Story. I don't know.
Well, remind listeners of the general plot of On the Town.
Well, the show opened in late December of 1944, and it was a very current plot. It was about three sailors on leave, a one-day leave in New York City, going out to just kind of cut loose and experience the city. Some of them had never been to New York before, so they have kind of hayseeds coming out from their ears, and they're spending this day not knowing how long life will be. And they're going to be going back on their ship, back to battle, and the whole show is very funny with beautiful music, but it has this underlying worry and sadness, which was very present during World War II.
Mm. It also has an enduring favorite song. You know, even if On the Town hasn't been mounted a lot in the post-West Side Story years, people still remember this song from Bernstein's On the Town.
New York, New York, New York, New York. It's a hell of a town. We've got one day here and not another minute to see the famous sights.
We'll find the romance and danger waiting in it beneath the Broadway lights.
Oh, we've hair on our chests, so what we like the best are the nights.
Sightlights,
nights, New York, New York, a hell of a town. The Bronx is up, but the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a hell of a town.
Hey, Gaby, it says here there are 20,000 streets in New York, not counting McDougal Alley in the heart of Greenwich Village, a charming thoroughfare.
Here we go again.
Hey, the famous places to visit are so many, or so the guidebooks say. And I promised Daddy I wouldn't miss on any, and we have just one day. Gotta see the whole town right from Yonkers on down to the bay.
New York, New York is, of course, from On the Town, from the book Bernstein Meets Broadway, Collaborative Art in a Time of War. We learn all about the backstory of this song and the the Three Sailors Carol, who are in New York for just a day, and there's a couple of girls. There's not quite enough girls for the three guys. There's, you know, a lot of that kind of tension in the story as well. But it is a wartime piece. Why are these 20-something Bernstein, Robbins, Compton and Green, why are they in New York and not, you know, in the service at that point?
Oh, well, with Bernstein and Robbins, they both were deferred from the service. They were not drafted. And with Adolph Green, he too did not serve, but I'm not sure why. Betty Comden's husband was in the service.
Right. But Bernstein was deferred for, was it?
Asthma.
Asthma. I mean,
right. So he was 4F. Right.
And Robbins, also 4F, for being gay.
Well, that's the story.
Yeah.
I mean, he told friends afterwards that he was asked if he had ever had a gay sexual encounter, and he replied, last night.
Yeah.
Which immediately eliminated a person from the military during World War II.
All right, so they're here in New York, and there's like this kind of coalescing of a community of artists, you know, at a time of war, and they're really beginning to break a lot of boundaries, you know. There is this kind of... kind of sexual tension in the musical, but then there's also a kind of racial tension as well.
Well, there is. The creative artists involved in this show were all the children of Jewish immigrants to the United States. They'd all faced racism and anti-Semitism themselves. They'd all had to kind of buck the system to get to a point of starting to emerge. And they were all involved politically and involved on the left and very involved in civil rights issues during the 1940s. So at the time this show emerged, there was a major push within the civil rights community to try to eliminate stereotypes on the stage and screen and to increase the racial diversity of casts.
Yeah. Now, Billy, as someone who came into that cast towards the end of the Broadway run, you know, what was it like to see a mixed-race cast up on that stage?
Well, it was very exciting because I came from the segregated South to New York to study ballet and theater. And it was very exciting because I was involved in the civil rights struggle. My mother was an activist. I could be called the red diaper baby, we'll say that. And so I was ready for this atmosphere. I understood it. And it was a powerful force. And I'd seen the reviewers at Cafe Society. I lived in that community for a while when I first came to New York, near Cafe Society. And they were just absolutely on key, on at all times, what they were saying, what they were doing, and working in the Borscht Belt to create Saturday night shows for mm-hmm. the hotels up there. I had done that. And it was just amazing.
Did you have a feeling of being part of something that in its own way was being subversive, was you know, manning the barricades?
I had the thrill of being involved in something huge, something wonderful, something evolving, something that I had been working with my mother with groups. Something to change what's going on and to be more inclusive in the American life. And here I walk into it right on the stage. Hmm. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Yeah. Well, instead, you went out on the road. And what was it like having that mixed race cast once you got out of New York and into other parts of the country?
Oh, it was adventurous, if you want to say. There were places where I traveled... with two of my friends from the School of American Ballet. And we shared a room or suite or whatever. And we had some wonderful times. And it was always a little bit dicey and exciting, I would say.
Yeah. Billy Allen is an early cast member of On the Town and has had a long career in theater and dance. And Carol Oja is the William Powell Mason Professor of Music and American Studies at Harvard University and author of this book called Bernstein Meets Broadway, Collaborative Art in a Time of War. So, Carol, there is this mixed race. You know, they're doing their bit to kind of push that conversation forward at least a step or two in the middle of the war. But then there's also... the kind of empowerment of the female characters. You know, it isn't, when I mentioned the sexual tension before, it's not just like three guys who are in town and are, you know, looking for a good time. It's like the girls have something to say about this as well. And there's a song called I Can Cook Too, which, you know, you, in the book you go through some of the kind of the lyrics of the songs and kind of mine them for what would have been at the time pretty saucy double entendres.
They're still saucy double entendres. And the show in many ways is just downright racy, but from a female perspective. So these women are lusty and they are not afraid at all of showing it. And sometimes their lust is a vehicle for comedy. Often it is. But it's raucous comedy, and it's very feminist comedy.
And would this, too, have been somewhat unusual for Broadway? Was this something that would have been more suited to the nightclub scene?
Probably so. I mean, it was very out there for Broadway, very young and very sort of audacious, trimmed down a little by George Abbott, who was the director, and I think contained the enthusiasms and the political energy of his creative team and his cast. Nonetheless, this for its day was really very present and loudly stated.
So we're talking about On the Town, which opens on October 16th at the Lyric Theater. But here's a little bit of this song. We hear the character Chip asking the female cab driver, Hildy, what they should do. And the answer comes in this song called I Can Cook Too.
So now what?
We eat, huh?
Yeah, we could do that first.
What's the specialty of the house?
Me. My fish can't be beat. My sugar's the sweetest around. I'm a man's ideal of the perfect meal, right down to the delicatess. I'm a pot of joy for a hungry boy. Baby, I'm cooking with gas, 'cause I'm a gumdrop, a sweet lollipop, a brook trout right out of the brook. And what's more, baby, I can cook. Some girls make magazine covers. Some girls keep house on a dime. Some girls make wonderful lovers. But what a lucky find I'm. I'd make a magazine cover. I do keep house on a dime. I'd make a wonderful
I Can Cook Too is the name of the song from On the Town. Lyrics by Comden and Green, music by Leonard Bernstein. Carol Loge's book recounts the genesis of this this extraordinary work from the World War II years. In the book, Bernstein Meets Broadway, Collaborative Art in a Time of War. It is out now. Billy Allen, also with us on Soundcheck, an early cast member of On the Town, singing along to that song here in the studio as we were listening.
I can't get it out of my head. I was shocked with I Can Cook Too. I
mean, did it shock you?
It made me blush. It really, really did. And Nancy Walker was just so convincing. I thought, oh my goodness, you know. And then it was a wonderful time of learning for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was probably a time of learning for everyone involved, I would think, Carol. I mean, Bernstein was feeling his way for this kind of blend of high culture and pop culture that would become so important to him. Comden and Green are learning the biz. Jerome Robbins is learning how to collaborate with all these people. They're still young, right?
They are all in their mid-20s when this show emerges. And looking back, it's pretty astounding because in almost every case, say starting with Bernstein, the style that we know them for, the voice that we know them for was there, was already developed.
Well, now you do point out in the book that On the Town is essentially based on the previous Jerome Robbins, Leonard Bernstein collaboration, Fancy Free.
That's right. A ballet from like about 9 months earlier. So the show was developed very quickly.
Right.
And there is no music that's held over from the ballet to the show, but the basic plot line is the same.
Right. And, of course, it's Broadway. And as you said, the director was kind of reining in of the sensibilities.
Well, plus Betty Comden has entered the creative team. So there is a very strong female voice.
Right.
So the balances then have shifted by the time of the show.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So a song like Lucky to Be Me, you know, sort of that this is Comden and Green, you know, sort of that you've got that kind of mix of genders that you didn't have in the earlier piece, right? The idea that it's not just a boys' club anymore.
It is not at all. No. And Lucky to Be Me is a ballad, it's striving to be a ballad that speaks to audiences in the 1940s in the way that they're used to having swing-era ballads sound.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, it's Bernstein and Comden and Green being young and experimental. It's also them sort of plugging into known expectations for a Broadway show in their day.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the song, Lucky to Be Me, from Leonard Bernstein's On the Town with lyrics by Comden and Green.
I used to think it might be fun to be anyone else but me. I thought that it would be a pleasant surprise to wake up as a couple of other guys. But now that I've found you, I've changed my point of view. And no, I wouldn't give a dime to be anyone else but me. What a day fortune smiled and came my way, bringing love I never thought I'd see. I'm so lucky to be me. What a night, suddenly you came in sight, looking just the way I hoped you'd be. I'm so lucky to be me. I am simply thunderstruck at the change in my luck. Knew at once I wanted
Lucky to Be Me from On the Town, a collaboration between Leonard Bernstein, choreographer Jerome Robbins, and the lyric writing team of Comden and Green, all in their 20s. It was 1944 so still, you know, the country at war, hence the subtitle of Carol Loge's book, Bernstein Meets Broadway, Collaborative Art in a Time of War. Carol's been with us on Soundcheck, along with Billy Allen, an early cast member of On the Town. Billy, will you be going to see the current revival of the show?
I have several tickets.
No, so you're going to
see
it a couple of times.
There'll be several viewings.
And does the piece still...
Oh, it does. It's very hot. And the music is exceptional. And think of the way they use language. I'm so lucky to be me. And the way... It was just absolutely brilliant, I say.
Yeah. On the Town opens at the Lyric Theater on October 16th. Carol Loge's book, Bernstein Meets Broadway, is out now. Carol, Billy, to the two of you, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Next, members of the Wordless Music Orchestra unveil some of their new arrangement of Tubular Bells, the jovial Mike Oldfield classic that was used to such creepy effect in the movie The Exorcist. Stick around, this is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This music will forever be associated with the horror movie classic, The Exorcist. But it was never meant to be scary. It's actually the opening of an album-length piece by Mike Oldfield called Tubular Bells. And it's kind of a rollicking good time if you can get past the long association with demonic possession and colorful projectile vomiting. Tubular Bells launched Mike Oldfield's career, and it also launched the Virgin Records empire, which in turn spawned Virgin Airways and Virgin Books and the upcoming Virgin Orbital Trips for super-rich thrill-seekers. So it's a pretty important work. But it has never been played live in New York. Until now. Members of the Wordless Music Orchestra are unveiling a new arrangement of Tubular Bells this week in New York, and they're here to give us a taste of it now. And actually, this taste begins with a part that is a little scary sounding. From Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, here's a little of part one played live on soundcheck by the Wordless Music Orchestra.
Thank you.
Members of the Wordless Music Orchestra, live on Soundcheck with an excerpt from Mike Oldfield's now 40-year-old classic called Tubular Bells, a work that includes everything but the kitchen sink. It does, in fact, include tubular bells in the original, but Wordless Music Orchestra with a new arrangement done by guitarist Gray McMurray, who joins me here at the microphones. Hey, Gray.
Hi.
And Clarice Jensen playing the cello, Olga Bell on keyboards and vocals, Kasim Naqvi behind our drum kit, Justin Carroll's at our piano, Aaron Roach on acoustic guitar, and Chris Morrissey playing the bass. So that's seven of the eight musicians, Gray, yes, that you've arranged this for. Caleb Burhans, the violinist, couldn't be with us today. Well, now, the original Tubular Bells was largely Mike Oldfield overdubbing over and over, one instrument atop the other in the studio.
Yep. And being a kid.
He was 19.
He was a child. Yeah.
Yeah. So how is the piece constructed? Is it kind of, do the pieces kind of vary themes that we've heard before?
Well, from what I gather from spending a lot of time recently with it, there are a number of themes that he brings back and puts at times in supporting roles, at times in sort of focal roles. It feels guilelessly self-important. It feels like really, really honestly like a kid trying to make something dramatic. And that sounds so obnoxious for me to say a kid, but it's really, you know, someone taking himself seriously and trying to say, oh my gosh, this is all real.
Well, it's worth saying that Mike Oldfield at age 19 was already a veteran.
Yeah.
You know, he had been on the English kind of proto-art rock scene for a number of years already. How did you first hear Tubular Bells? Where did you first hear it?
I got the record because the cover is so strange looking. And I thought it was a early, like, new age record, but just because there were clouds and then a metal pipe. But so I had it on LP, and then I heard the first part, and I was like, oh, this is that song.
And from The Exorcist.
From The Exorcist, yeah. But really, the first time I heard the whole thing was when this project came into view, and I, you know, initially was like, oh, this is great. And then hearing the whole thing, it was like, ha, okay.
What have I done? Yeah. What have I agreed to? Mm-hmm. What do you use for the tubular bells?
We're going to have tubular bells.
You will have tubular bells.
We actually will, yeah.
So, you know, for all the associations over the years with The Exorcist, it's actually at times a very jovial piece, and there's a kind of a droll British wit to it as well.
Yeah, it feels right before a lot of very proggy moments are about to happen coming out of that part of the world. But at the same time, it is going back to it seeming and being from someone very young. There's still this kind of put together and janky quality to it. And it still has some mysterious, not to have anything to do with the association with The Exorcist, but, you know, it sounds like it's made from someone who's rather quiet and slightly odd.
Hmm. That would be Mike Oldfield in this case.
He's not. I don't mean to say that. I don't know. But, you know, at least when I paint my picture.
It's a very, very British record. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Tubular Bells by Mike Oldfield. The world premiere of this arrangement from the Wordless Music Orchestra is Thursday evening, 7:30 p.m. in a free concert at Brookfield Place, formerly the World Financial Center, in the beautiful Winter Garden Atrium. Gray McMurray did the arrangement. And speaking of wit, there is an important role on the original recording for Viv Stansall from the Bonzo Dog Band. Mm-hmm. What is his role?
He is the master of ceremonies that is first heard at the end of part one, where he introduces all the instruments that are used. And the way that he announces on the record, if you're familiar with it, is with a lot of character and rather strange.
Yeah, it's almost like the Britain Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra.
Yeah. Oh, totally, yeah, yeah. Except with someone that probably is drunk doing it, you know.
Which gets me to the part of the piece you're going to play for us next. You're going to do the real ending of Tubular Bells.
Well, I think so.
Which did not appear on the original LP. Why?
I don't know why it didn't.
Well, isn't it because he was so drunk? Well,
maybe it is because he was so drunk. It certainly seems like that's that seems true enough. So at the end, there's a script that we are lucky to have you going to be reading that is Viv Stansall saying non sequitur after non sequitur.
And so the story goes that the album was recorded at The Manor, this beautiful old house in Oxfordshire, and when the record is done, Viv Stansall is taking the crew on a drunken tour of the manor.
Yeah.
And
oh man. Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
And that is where this text comes from.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
There you go.
So you want to play it?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. We're speaking with Gray McMurray, who has done this brand new arrangement of Mike Oldfield's early 70s favorite called Tubular Bells. Members of the Wordless Music Orchestra here in the Soundcheck studio to give us the real ending of Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells. The hallway. From the outside, an ordinary house. A great house, true. 483 rooms, each one with its own marble wash basin and douche. Bidet, as it's known. But inside... And the positions are reversed. A human failing, some say a disease. But a disease that Sir Francis Dashwood knew and used well. Upstairs, inside, and a revelation, it's a discotheque. There are paintings. Real. And look here. A rare 17th century masterpiece. If I can scrape a little of it off, beneath I can find hidden a 14th century underpiece made entirely of tiny pieces of eggshell. This lurid work has caused controversy in the world of embroidery and anthropology. Noah, I'll say it again. Anthropology. Not quite possibly making an epilogue. It has distinguished and enthralled professors, and in layman's language, it's blinking well baffling. But to be more obtusely, buggered if I know. Yes, buggered if I know. And that's all we've gleaned so far from experts in 14th century painting, Renaissance greengrocers, and recently revived members of the public. Buggered if I know. Vivian Stanchel, about 3 in the morning, Oxfordshire, 1973. Good night. That is how the piece Tubular Bells by Mike Oldfield might have ended, but didn't, when the original album was released back in the early 70s with the Sailor's Hornpipe, which does in fact make it onto the record, but also with the late Viv Stanchel's drunken narration leading the team through the manor in Oxfordshire where the album was made. Gray McMurray did the arrangement, the Wordless Music Orchestra, here live on Soundcheck. I mentioned before, Mike Oldfield has never done Tubular Bells here in New York live. Mm-hmm. He did Tubular Bells 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, because I interviewed him then, he was pretty upfront about Tubular Bells 2 being his own attempt at nicking, as he put it, his own work, because everybody else had nicked it over the years, mm-hmm. you know. How important, how influential do you think Tubular Bells has been?
I think any instrumental record that reaches that many people can't help but be very influential just in an economic way, just people noticing that, oh, by this point it's like 18 million records sold.
Yeah.
And it changed the way that people scored movies, not just our movies. It changed the way that people thought a record could be. And for a moment, it made prog music something that was a viable commercial entity. And
it made Virgin Records.
And it made Virgin Records. It made Richard Branson a household name.
Made him a gazillionaire.
Yeah.
And enabled
yeah.
him to go to space at some point.
Yeah,
so.
His first plane, Tubular Bell. Huh?
Right.
Check that out. Right.
So the performance will be Thursday night. It's a free event at Brookfield Place in the Winter Garden Atrium, 7:30 Thursday evening. The world premiere of this arrangement of Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells. Great. It sounds great. I can't wait to hear the whole thing. And thanks so much for playing some of it for us today.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Spanish guitar and introducing acoustic guitar.
Tomorrow on the show, a conversation with Scott Ian, guitarist from the influential metal band Anthrax, plus a look back at the 1981 film Stations of the Elevated and its soundtrack, which was filled with the music of Charles Mingus. And New York musician Ahmed Jalab returns to the studio with his project Syncane. They'll perform songs from a new album called Mean Love. All of that tomorrow on Soundcheck. And a reminder to join us for a special afternoon concert with the band Primus in the Green Space on October 30th, 1 p.m. For tickets and details about the costume you should wear, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.